incidents or things that have happened to you in the course of not just what we've been doing here, but in general about meditation practice. In this afternoon's discussion, we can move into more philosophical or other such matters. But let's try to keep it really practical in this session now. Yes.
Just happened to share with a group of you who might not be, regular meditators. I'm not a regular meditator, but I tried doing 10 minutes a day recently, and just to say I found that really, really beneficial, just for 10 minutes a day.
Thank you. If you don't mind, I'll repeat the gist of that so it's on the recorder. A comment from a lady in the audience saying how useful she's found it just to meditate for 10 minutes a day. And perhaps for those of us who are not committed, say, to a practice, to bear in mind that even these short periods can be enormously beneficial. And I would support that very much. In many ways, it's the quality of the time you spend rather than the duration that often is more effective. And a common question is, you know, how much should I sit every day? And as though there's some sort of necessary requirement to, sit still for 30 minutes or 40 minutes. And different traditions will give you different answers to that question. But I think if we understand this practice more as developing a certain life skill, and part of that skill is basically learning how to interrupt and stop the habitual rush or inertia of thoughts and habits and worries and so on. A considerable part of this is finding periods in the day where you can just take a pause and stop. You might come back to the breath or some other object, but the crucial thing really is to open up spaces in your life where you can take stock. You can look more clearly and carefully about how you feel, about what's going on in your experience, but from a kind of non-reactive space. I think a lot of what we're working with is what loosely we might call reactivity, habitual, instinctive, or conditioned reactivity that prompts us to act and think and speak in somewhat familiar and also often very predictable ways. This kind of meditation is about questioning that is that the most appropriate way to get through life, just by being a creature of habit? And so what we do, whether it be for 40 minutes or for 10 minutes or arguably just for 2 minutes or 30 seconds, is to introduce gaps, interruptions to the habitual flow of things. Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese meditation teacher, tries to encourage people to utilize the little moments during our daily existence when we're not necessarily occupied with anything. There's a break of 5 minutes before an appointment we're about to have, and to try to utilize these moments as a means to sort of reconnect with this quality of a more contemplative awareness. So it might be most suited for you to sit only for 10 minutes or so a day. Others may enjoy more, but also to try to find moments, unstructured moments, in which you can also utilize, even for briefer periods, to just stop and look and see what's going on. Yes.
Can I ask about the practice of loving kindness?
Uh-huh.
Because you were saying earlier that it's more about the mindfulness of the breath.
Mm.
And is there space for the practice of loving kindness, or how does that compassion arise?
The question has to do with the practice of loving kindness. I had emphasized the centrality of breathing awareness, and the questioner would like to know how this loving kindness practice works, and how it fits in, and what role it plays in the broad cultivation of meditation. Is that correct? There are many teachers today within this broad world of vipassana and mindfulness who give quite some emphasis to the practice of loving kindness. Those of you who are not familiar with this, it basically involves calming the mind initially, and then instead of paying attention to the breathing or the body, to quietly repeat certain phrases. May I be happy, may you be happy, may all beings be well. There are different ways in which this can be done. And the aim of this exercise, I feel, is to bring into your meditation a degree of heartfulness, a degree of a kind of more emotional quality, an affective quality to the meditation. So it's not just about, as it were, observing in a kind of detached way what's happening, but proactively introducing a certain aspiration or volition, wishing others well, wishing oneself well, seeking to remind oneself of the suffering of the world, of the suffering of oneself, and setting a motivation to respond to that in a wise and loving and compassionate way. Now, some people find this practice very effective, not only as a means of generating these particular emotions and affects, but also as a means of deepening concentration. In fact, in many traditional Buddhist countries, the recitation of the loving kindness phrases is used as a means whereby to enter into deeper states of meditative absorption. Some of you may have done this kind of practice. The reason being that the generation of kindness or care or compassion induces a certain sense of well-being, a certain sense of a kind of inner goodness about oneself, about others. And it's that sense of well-being that can also be used to deepen into a more focused kind of awareness as well. In my own case, I've not done a great deal of this particular practice, although I've done similar exercises in the Tibetan tradition connected to what's called bodhicitta, which is the aspiration to attain awakening for the sake of others. And many of the... it's very similar in many ways. And there's a practice called Donglen, giving and receiving, that some of you might be familiar with, which is very similar to the metta or loving kindness. I think we need to find practices that actually speak to us and meet our particular needs, and I'm cautious about saying you should do this or you must do that or whatever. I think each of us has to evolve a practice that that somehow works for us in what particular set of needs we find ourselves in at a given time. My own sense is that loving kindness or generosity or compassion or care, that these are qualities or virtues that generally begin to ripen in the course of the entire context of this practice that we're doing, and are not necessarily things we have to consciously make an effort to cultivate. There's very little in the suttas, in the early discourses, where the Buddha encourages any such practices. But he does speak a great deal of how the person who is committed to this way of life comes to live with, he says, a mind pervading all quarters with kindness, with compassion, with equanimity, and with a sympathetic joy or rejoicing in others' well-being. So clearly it has an integral part, it is an integral part of this culture that we might be speaking of here, and you may find it very valuable at times to focus on consciously raising those kinds of concerns in your meditation. Particularly if you find your meditation is getting a little dry or a little cold, a little bit analytic, maybe a little bit detached and cut off, to switch track and actively affirm certain positive feelings of this kind can be very valuable. Yes.
So my question is about consistency of method mm-hmm. in practicing meditation. There are many different methods. For instance, attending to the breath or to sounds, or noting, mm-hmm. Mahasi method. And just if you can speak a little bit to the importance of consistency and keeping that up through sitting periods or changing it if mm-hmm. needs, if it feels right.
Okay. The question has to do with the matter of consistency in a practice. There are many different approaches. We have, listening to sounds, paying attention to the breath, to the body, cultivating loving kindness, many different exercises that are used. And the questioner would like some reflection on how important it is to stick to one particular method and to really focus on that, or could we be more, let's say, eclectic in our approach? You didn't use the word eclectic. But, do we sort of mix and match? I think there's two answers to this question. First of all, I think, as with any skill or exercise that we undertake, if we are to be successful at it, and this is we're not talking of meditation here, playing football or learning how to read Portuguese, you need to dedicate yourself to achieving that particular goal. If as soon as you get a bit bored or fed up with it you go on and do something else, you'll never actually achieve much at all in the end. It's somewhat dilettantish, I suppose. The other side of the coin, though, is that we become rather too narrow-minded and rigid about this practice being the practice. And sometimes you'll find in the rhetoric of Buddhist meditation traditions that this particular meditation is the highest one or the most profound one or whatever. And we must be careful, I think, not to fall for that. There's nowhere, I feel, in the discourses of the Buddha where the Buddha singles out, one particular practice to the at the expense of all others. In fact, he seems to be offering a whole range of approaches and offering them in different combinations and in different forms. And I think what that points to is that we must be careful not to slip into the idea that the practice of meditation is rather like some kind of spiritual problem-solving technique. And if we're good at that technique, if we get proficient at it, we'll solve our problems. And sometimes Buddhism presents the problem as being human suffering, meditation is a technique that can solve the problem of human suffering, and this is the best technique, you must do that. I don't find that very helpful. I find that, even though it might be helpful at the outset to get consistency and competence in a particular approach, if it's done to the exclusion of pretty much every other aspect of our life, I think we're in danger of becoming too constrained by commitment to a particular technique. In fact, I think we should be quite careful about thinking of meditation as a technique or a technology, a sort of spiritual technology. But I'll come back a bit to that this afternoon. So I think in many ways it's useful to think of these different forms of meditation practice as like different tools in a toolkit. And to develop these different tools, as with the metaphor of the toolkit, implies that at certain times in one's life, particular approaches will be called for, and at other times, other approaches, both in terms of our own inner state of mind and in terms of the kind of life situations in which we find ourselves. So my reading of the early canonical texts, and also from my training as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, focused very much on becoming familiar and competent in a range of approaches, and not thinking there is one thing called meditation. Meditation is a generic term for a whole range of skills. And I think for this practice to be effective in the wider context of our lives, we need to cultivate that multiplicity of approaches, and to learn what is the most appropriate style of practice at a given time. So it's a question of balance. Committing yourself to develop the skills will require consistency and focus. Becoming too focused, you will probably then avoid cultivating other practices that could be equally as important and necessary. And when the Buddha uses the word practice, or the closest Pali word to practice, bhavana, he doesn't restrict it even to meditation. The way we look at the world and the way we think and speak and act and work, all of these are described as bhavana. They're all described as practices. A bhavana literally means things we cultivation. So we cultivate a certain way of speaking, of working, of acting, of thinking. And all of that is subsumed under the heading of practice. And meditation falls under that heading too, obviously. Mindfulness and concentration and so on. So in the still bigger picture, I think it's helpful to go beyond the idea that my practice involves becoming good at a certain form of meditation, and expanding the notion to encompass the totality of your humanity. In fact, all of that, life is practice. Being human is practice in that widest sense. Okay, one last question, then we'll break.
I've been reading quite a lot of notes on a couple of books by Jason Sith.
Oh, Jason, yeah.
And I know you endorsed one of his books, I think. He does challenge the way I've been taught something around relationship to thoughts.
Uh-huh.
One of his books is called Thoughts Are Not the Only. And I found it quite liberating, actually, and takes away quite a sort of superego of getting it wrong, that I often have in meditation. And I'm just wondering what your take on what and you're thinking about relation to thoughts.
Okay. So the question has to do with the work of a meditation teacher called Jason Sith. And Jason has written a couple of books, one of which I endorsed, called Unlearning Meditation, which is a good title. It's a good book, too, actually. I'd encourage you to read it. And what's his second book called?
Thoughts Are Not the Enemy.
Thoughts Are Not the Enemy. And Jason was a monk in Sri Lanka. He's written, he's a writer, he's... a Buddhist thinker, as it were. And what he's pointing out in his work is that we sometimes become so preoccupied with getting the meditation technique right that comes to dominate what we do in our practice. And his approach is actually to turn that on its head and say, actually, when you sit down in meditation, don't first of all think, now I will watch my breath, or now I will generate loving kindness. But the first step is to basically acknowledge what's going on in your life, what's going on in your thoughts, what's going on in your head, and not to feel that that's a problem. This is, I think, a fair account. Not to immediately problematize your mind. This is a problem, and this is my Buddhist technique, and I'm going to solve this problem. But rather to actually honour and respect the fact that this is how your life is manifesting in this moment, and to honour likewise the need for that. It's not necessarily a distraction or something neurotic, but to actually respect what it is that's right coming up for you, and in a sense listening to your own inner needs and wisdom, perhaps, to guide what it is that you then pursue in your practice of meditation. So to take the lead from your own state of being, rather than taking the lead from what your teacher or some Buddhist text tells you to do. And I think that's very useful. I think most meditation teachers are aware of this problem, but there is, I think, a kind of a often an unquestioned assumption that when you meditate, you do exercise X or exercise Y. And that becomes your practice, irrespective of how you might actually be feeling in that moment. So again, I think in some ways, this whole practice is a kind of ongoing conversation between your own way of being, who you are, what's going on for you, and in this context, meditation exercises, maybe certain texts or doctrines or whatever. And as we evolve in this practice, we basically are pursuing an ongoing conversation between my own experience and the whatever particular approaches or teachings or practices that we are working with. And it's out of that conversation, out of that dialogue, I think, that one matures a practice that becomes increasingly your own. And again, I think this is a term we find quite a lot in the early canonical texts, where the Buddha encourages you to become independent of others in the teaching. It's an oft-repeated phrase, independent of others in the teaching or the practice. And so I think if we bear in mind Jason Siff's critique, that I think can help us perhaps achieve a greater autonomy in our practice, so that we no longer feel beholden to the authority of someone else or some external text or whatever, but we learn more and more to find what's appropriate in the given moment when we sit down on the cushion, or we sit down on a chair, or we say to ourselves, now I'm going to meditate. Let's leave it there for this morning. It's 20 to 1. We'll have an hour and 20 minutes for lunch.